midst of a series entitled Living in Moments of Darkness. Last week we looked at the life of the woman, Samaritan woman at the well, and hopefully we saw that no matter how much of a regretful life we have lived, that God's grace is always greater. I didn't point it out last Sunday, but the woman at the well may have been the very first evangelist. She is the one that took Jesus to her village, and in that village came to know Christ. And so what a change that occurred. This morning, we want to look at Psalm 137 and Israel in exile. I want to begin this sermon by asking a question. It's a question that's pretty easy to understand. Any two-year-old can comprehend this question, but it's not that easy to answer. So here's the question. What do you want? Now, if you're at a restaurant and a waiter asks you what do you want, so you have the context of a menu, right? You can choose what you want to eat. If your spouse asks you what do you want, you got the context of a relationship, right? Your marriage. What do you want from this relationship? If your boss asks you what do you want, you have the context of your job, right? What job assignment do you want, or what's your career goal? But my question to you this morning has no specific context, or perhaps better, it's life itself. If you can transcend every situation in life and you were asked the question, what do you want, how would you respond? I start with this question because I believe this is one of the most difficult and yet one of the most significant questions that you can ever ask of yourself. I believe how you answer this question tells me more about you than what you know or what you have done. Throughout Western philosophy, scholars have been attempting to answer the question, you know, what is the essence of the human being? What is it that separates from the animals and makes us like God? And the primary answer that's been offered is thinking. We are thinking beings. We are individuals who deliberate rationally, right? Research for truth. This position has been encapsulated by that most famous declaration, I think, therefore I am, right? Students take entire years of philosophy class, and that's the only thing they remember. And this view believes that the more we fill our minds with truth, the more our lives will change. So we format our sermons and our Bible studies as sources of information, right? The more information we have about God, the more our lives will change. So we read books, we listen to podcasts, in hopes of finding that deep insight, that knowledge of God that will change your lives. For the sake of argument, let's call this intellectualism. On the other side, human beings are viewed as being human doers. So it is actions that define who we are. So that if that's the thinker, this is the one who multitasks. The more we do, the more we are. Stupid is what stupid does, Forrest Gump tells us. We are what we do. In this model, the goal is faithfulness. When God's gifts, life situations, opportunities, and our work ethic come together, we get things done. We get lots of things done. The call of the spiritual life is to serve, right? And that's what the Bible teaches. We are to serve. And transformation comes when we conform our behavior to the commands of God. Obedience is the key. Thus, the church's job is to provide clear explanations of what God expects from us. So we develop step-by-step guides. There's a lot of how-to sermon titles, right? So how to get out of depression, how to forgive, how to share the gospel, how to deal with lust. Let's call this position activism. Now, while there are obvious truths to both views, there's a danger of overemphasis. So take intellectualism. I think we all know that knowledge alone does not cause spiritual growth. We know that. If this was the case, seminaries would be filled with spiritual giants. I can testify firsthand, the more you know does not mean necessarily that you are more spiritual. In fact, knowledge isn't even the primary ingredient to spirituality. I take brokenness any day over more knowledge. In fact, there's a danger to too much knowledge, right? In 1 Corinthians chapter 8, Paul says, look, if you can have all this knowledge, but if you don't have love, it doesn't make you a servant. It makes you more puffed up. It gives you something to boast about. But there's a danger to activism as well. Unless one is extremely careful, faithfulness can quickly degenerate into a lust for success. Success that strokes my ego. Success can become an idol that I worship. But there is a third proposal, one that predates the previous two. It goes all the way back to St. Augustine. And he argued that a human being is defined by their deepest desire. That what we long for, what we yearn, what we want, tells us more about who we are than how much we know or how much we do. So the question of what do you want is crucial, not only because it tells us what kind of person we are, but because when we stand before God, this is the first question He's going to ask you. That on the day of judgment, when you stand before God, His first question to you will not be how many Bible verses you know or how much theology you can regurgitate. It will not be how much did you serve or how many people did you share the gospel with. It'll be what did you really want in your heart? What was your deepest desire? What did you really yearn for? Or perhaps better, what did you worship? Because that which you want most is that which you worship. Everybody worships something. When Jesus encountered two disciples of John following him, he turns around and he asks them, what do you want? One day, Jesus as judge will look at us and ask us, what do you really want? First question raises a second one. How do you know what you want is really what you want? If I asked you, what do you want, and you gave me an answer, how do you know that you're not deceiving me? Well, how do I know you're not deceiving me? But more importantly, how do you know you're not deceiving yourself? Perhaps you don't even know what you want. I'd like to use a movie to illustrate this, and maybe this movie will be offensive to some of you, and I certainly don't agree with everything that's in this movie, and I wouldn't use it, except I can't find a better illustration than this. It is an Academy Award winning movie, and it's not a recommendation for you to watch. See, all of these qualifications, you wonder, what the heck is this movie? Right? Well, it's American Beauty. The main character is a man by the name of Lester. Lester. He's like millions of fathers and husbands. He's a man who has lost himself in the everyday routine of suburban life. He gets up, he showers, he goes to work, comes home, eats dinner, watches a little TV, sleeps, and then hits the repeat button for the next day. Lester doesn't know who he is. And his life is one chaotic mess because he's constantly browbeaten by his wife. His daughter is emotionally distant. His boss is a jerk. He hates his job. And then one day, new neighbors come in, and there's this young man who refuses to allow society to define who he is. He is his own man. And Lester is mesmerized by this kind of freedom. He is inspired. And so he makes a series of decisions to take back his life from these carbon copy days, and he takes ownership, right? I'm going to be the voice of my own life, thank you very much. You can't tell me what to do. And so he quits his job. And then one of the first things he does is to set his desires upon his daughter's girlfriend. He lusts after Angela. And she consumes his life until he is obsessed with her. And he begins to work out and dress up and begins the process of seduction. Until towards the end of the movie, when through a series of circumstances, he is just about to reach his goal. And Lester is beginning to undress her. And he asks her, what do you want? And she says, I don't know. What do you want? And Lester realizes for the first time that the object of his passion is just a scared little girl. That she's young enough to be his daughter. And he wakes up in this delusional desire to recapture his youth by seducing her, and sees that she's this little child, and by neutrality. He sees that he is the father and fathers ought to protect little girls. And the scene shifts from the sofa to the kitchen, from seduction to making of a sandwich, and from a womanizer, he becomes a father figure, and he begins to listen to her struggles and her pains. But all throughout the movie, see, there's a glaring subtext. Whenever he imagines Angela, she's covered with roses. And the presence of roses is not merely aesthetic, but it's symbolic throughout the movie. It is a picture of his wife, Caroline. Because throughout the movie, the wife is continually praised for her rose-growing abilities. This is one of the few passions that she has in life. She doesn't do it to impress other people. She doesn't do it to make money. She does it because she really loves growing roses, and she's good at it. And throughout the movie, you see her weeding it and watering her rose bushes. And this is one of the key points of the movie. Lester thought that what he wanted was the symbol of a youth recaptured. But just before he gets to drink from the fountain of youth, he wakes up from his delusion and he realizes that it's not really Angela he has wanted all those days. It was really his wife that he wanted. After months of reorienting his life towards that target, what he thought he wanted wasn't really what he wanted. And the regretful part of that movie is that he is just days from his life coming to an end. And he never gets the opportunity to tell his wife how much he wanted her and desired her and missed her. So I ask you again, what do you want? Follow-up question, are you really sure that's what you want? Jeremiah writes that our hearts are deceitful above all things. It has the power not only to deceive us, but to deceive those around us. What if we are living a life of delusion, our lives calibrated to the wrong goal? You know, in the Harry Potter series, there's a mirror, right? The mirror of Erised. It's desire spelt backwards. It has the power to reveal what your heart truly wants. So that when a person stands before that mirror, it reflects back your deepest desire. If you stood before the mirror right now, what would you see? What would be the image that reflects back? I say, this doesn't mean that we're left totally clueless. There are ways that we can do a gut check. Like, I could ask you a series of questions to determine what is your deepest desire. So I have three questions. Question number one, what are you willing to compromise your integrity for? If there's something that you're willing to cheat for, lie for, cover up for, see, that's a pretty strong indication of what your heart really desires. So that last year I was reading a book on the power of stories to change your lives. And in this book, the author was using Lance Armstrong, you know, the cyclist, as a positive illustration. Here's a man, Lance Armstrong, who really understands what's important in life. Because the interviewer asked Lance Armstrong, if you had a choice between winning all those Tour de France and being a survivor of cancer, what would you choose? And Lance Armstrong said, by far, I would choose to be a survivor of cancer. To be a model for them that life doesn't end with cancer. You can still live on. And I thought, oh my God, when was this book written? And I checked the very front of the book. It was published in 2006 before Armstrong's confession of cheating and manipulation. What an illustration that what you say you want doesn't match what's really in your heart, because the fact that you're willing to cheat and lie for it tells me that you're either lying to yourself or you're deluded. See, Lance Armstrong can tell me all he wants, that he wants to be an inspiration for cancer survivors. But the fact that he compromised tells me that's not what he really wants. He doesn't want to be an inspiration. He's after the glory, the gold, the money. He wants to be known as the greatest cyclist that ever rode. Well, here's a second diagnostic question. What are you jealous of? You look around you, and let's say your neighbors or fellow church members, your students at school, You look and suddenly you see that they have something or they accomplish something. And then you suddenly feel this burning sensation of jealousy spread across you. You know, that's a pretty good indication that that's really what you want. You know, I'm headed towards the last decade of my vocational career. I just passed age 55. Just celebrated. Well, I'm not sure celebrated is the right word. I depressed my way through 56, and I can see 60 right around the corner. I have about 10 years of ministry left. To be honest, I'm not that jealous of too many things. Now, if someone drives a really fancy car, I can admire it, yeah, but I don't really want it. In fact, I don't like fancy cars. It gets too much pressure when I'm driving. Go to someone's house, it's a huge, decked-out home. Yeah, I like going visiting, but I don't want to clean it. I don't want to pay the mortgage. You know, I'm fine with an apartment. I'm pretty good. I don't really have that many issues. Someone on staff here, like Minister Chris or Elder Stanley, comes up and preaches an amazing sermon. That may give me a little bit of insecurity, yeah. but it's okay. I can handle that, too. I go home, take a nap, and have a quiet time, and I'm good, ready to go. I'm at Moody, and, you know, I have colleagues when I was teaching, and students would sign up for their classes, and they would have more students than me. I'm okay with that because, you know, I have pretty full classes as well, and I get good students. And so there's not really that much that I get jealous of except for one thing. If someone I knew wrote a book, I think I would get really jealous. Because it's happened a couple times. Because when I was at Moody, I would have colleagues who would publish a book. And then I hear about it. And then I sense this warm glow spread through my face, just like if I had a shot of bourbon. At least I'm told that's what happens when you have a shot of bourbon. I feel that jealousy. And then you know what they do at Moody? They give everyone a free copy. So, you know, I pick up my faculty meeting. I pick up my free copy. And I go, and even if I am interested in a topic, I can't read it. I can't get myself to open the book. To this day, I have never read a book that's written by someone I know. I just can't. And in fact, a lot of times I have thrown it into the trash can before going home because I don't want that book sitting on the library reminding me that he wrote a book and I haven't. True story. But it's not that I haven't published the book. I have published the book. My dissertation by an obscure German publisher. The last time I checked, it sold 6 copies. It gets worse. 4 of them bought by my family and friends, which means that only 2 copies had actually been sold. Last time I checked, there was 1 review. You got to buy this book. You got to read this book. It's great. It'll change your life. I know because the author is my father. Sweetest thing ever, my daughter Rachel, when she was about 12 or 13, had gone online and written that review. But it doesn't count. You know, if I looked at the mirror of Erised, I have a feeling that I will not see this congregation as much as I'm getting to like you. I don't think I'll see the cross. I think I will see a book cover with my name splashed, New York Times bestseller, the next Asian Tim Keller. How do I know that's not what I really want when I get so jealous of my peers writing books? Oh, man, that's great. I'm so happy for you. Then go back to my office and drop it in the trash can. There's one final test. What are you willing to suffer for? Willing to endure, put up with? And suffering for something is a clear indication of how deeply you long for something, right? If you give up too soon, well, it's most likely you didn't really want it, right? I find this dynamic in the history of Israel. They're on their way to the promised land. As long as things are going well, the path to their destination well marked out, right? The cloud by day and fire by night, and their stomachs are full. There's no enemies breathing down their back, and they're willing to follow Moses to the land of milk and honey when everything's going well. But as soon as they face the obstacles, trials, and sufferings, they turn on him. They grumble against him, and they go, you know, you should have left us at Egypt. You should have left the slaves to die. At least their pots were filled with meat, and we had plenty of bread. At least back there we had fish at no cost, cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic. And if you ask the Israelites at the beginning of the journey, right, you know, after those 10 earth-shattering miracles, and they're set free, and on their way out, right, they ask for gold, and all the Egyptians are giving them gold. You know, they're getting paid for all those years of slavery. And then that Red Sea, when it's split open, and one of the mightiest armies are drowned. And if you asked him, what do you really want? I think they would have said, I want to know this kind of God. I really want to know this God. And yet as soon as they're going through the journey, and they start becoming hungry, and the heat starts to make them thirsty, they want to go back to being enslaved. See, suffering has a wonderful way of removing the veneer of self-delusion, because we want to think we're better than we are. And so we lie to ourselves, this is what I really want, until suffering hits. And then we realize, oh my God, what I really wanted was a comfortable life. What I really want is not to have disease. What I really want is for my kids to do well. And, you know, if it's not God, I'll worship someone else. Because isn't that what the Egyptians did after all, right? The golden calf incident. It really doesn't matter what God you worship. As long as their lives are comfortable and their stomachs are full and the people around us are doing well. What do you really want? And how do you really know? That's it. Final question. Third question. This is the end of the sermon. Can you change what you want? I really don't like what I see and hear when I ask the question to myself. Can I change it? Isn't desire a natural element, right? You like what you like. You know, I go to Baskin Robbins 95% of the time. I get mint chocolate chip. That's my favorite. If you ask me, why do you like it? I can give you several answers. But at the bottom of it, at the bottom of all those answers, I just like it. I don't know. The heart likes what it likes, right? How can you change desire? But things are not as simple as that. If you cannot change what you want, then Christians bear no responsibility for their spiritual maturity, because wanting is more primal than what you know and what you do. So we have to be able to contribute to the changing of our desires. I believe we have control, but it's not direct. It's indirect control of our wanting. It's like falling asleep. Right now, you can't fall asleep, you're having trouble. You can't will yourself to sleep. You can't willpower yourself to sleep. The more you try, the more awake you become, right? But you are responsible for how well you sleep, not directly, but indirectly, because you can create the conditions whereby sleeping can come more readily. So that you can stay off the phone or your tablet or computer, right, right before bed, like 30 minutes. Yeah, you can take a warm bath. You don't drink coffee too close to nighttime, a dark and cool room, quiet your spirit before God. All of these things create the conditions for sleep, but it's indirect control, not direct. I think this is the same for your desires. You cannot will what you want, but you can practice certain spiritual disciplines that give room for the desires for God to be born and to be nurtured. And this is where I want to look at Psalm 137. So in Psalm 137, the first four verses, by the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. On the willows there, we hung up our lyres, and there our captives required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us a song, sing us one of the songs of Zion. See, this is the context. The writers of this psalm are refugees in a foreign land. They're in Babylon. Just like Daniel and his three companions, they've been deported from Israel into Babylon to be re-educated, you know, culturally assimilated so that they can serve their oppressors' political ends. But while they are there, they receive news that the temple in Jerusalem has been destroyed and their hearts are broken. The temple is the symbol of their identity as a people of God. This is where Yahweh came and dwelt and resided. And it was destroyed and they're heartbroken. So what they do is they make their way down to the rivers of Babylon. And they're mourning and they're weeping and they're crying. And they hung up their harps on the branches of the willow tree. Because there's no song in their heart. They didn't feel like singing. And to salt their wound, the Babylonians came down and they said, look, why don't you sing songs of God's faithfulness? Your God is that faithful and yet the temple is destroyed. Come on, let's hear you sing songs. This is like 18th century slave owners telling black slaves, why don't you sing and dance of your songs from Africa? Or this is like Nazis pushing Jews into the gas chamber saying, why don't you recite Psalms of the faithfulness of your God? It's torment. Hey, you're taking someone who's depressed and you're going to crush their spirit. And look what it says here now, verse 4 and on. How can we sing the songs of Lord's song in a foreign land? And then look at verse 5. If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. Do you see the shift that's occurring? Verse 4, how do we sing the Lord's songs when His promises do not seem to be fulfilled? And then the very next verse, how can we not sing His songs when I feel so depressed and so crushed? See, that's the other half. This is too much, even for the best of the Israelites. But notice from verse 4 to 5, this radical shift. When you don't feel like singing, you don't want to sing, that's when you ought to sing more. Because we need to remind ourselves how good God is and how faithful He is. You know, the worst thing you can do is not sing when you don't want to. In fact, I think God is more pleased when you sing when you don't feel like it as an act of faith. Because songs are like stories in poetic form. Songs are like stories with melody. And you know what the best thing about these songs? It's a psalm. It says we. Because you don't sing along. It's not like you're in your room with your iPod. This is like, you know, you need to come to church because when we sing together and I look over and I see people singing, what I find is that there's a communal power of helping each other shape our desires for God. So that when I come to church sometimes and I don't feel like singing and I look over and I see people singing, I'm caught up in the Spirit and they are like wings that enable me to float until I catch my own voice and I'm singing to God. And songs are like stories. And stories move our heart. And when I sing these songs, I'm reminded of Bible stories. And these stories are reminders that our God is ever for us and He does not abandon us. When you don't feel like singing, how can I sing songs in a foreign land? You need to ask yourself, how can I not sing when I don't feel like singing? You cannot control what your heart wants, but you can choose which songs you sing. Because you will always sing a song. Everyone worships something. The question is, what are you worshiping? Everyone sings a song. It depends what song you're singing. And the psalmist is afraid that if you stop singing the songs of Jerusalem and Zion, that you will one day begin to sing the songs of Babylon. Because everyone sings a song. See, the theme of the sermon stuck close to home about a year ago. A year ago, I went back up to Chicago and I had a breakfast with a friend of mine, and his friend is early 50s now, and he's a psychiatrist. He's well educated. He has 3 masters, and he's a psychiatrist. He has a great personality. He's single though, and he wants to get married, so he's on all these dating websites, and he's going on dates constantly. And 95% of our discussions is about his dating experiences, and that's okay. I'm happy, you know. I'm married, so And I console him, and he doesn't want to spend life alone. So we're sitting there at breakfast, and he looks at me and he says, David, what do you think about a Christian marrying a non-believer? And I'm thinking, where is this coming from? Why is he asking me this question? Because he wants me to officiate his wedding. And he knows that I will not officiate a believer and an unbeliever. It's my theological conviction. So he's asking this question. I'm wondering, why is he asking me? And then he goes on and he talks about this woman that's met. And she's a doctor that works in the same hospital. And he says, you know, whenever I'm with her, I feel so comfortable. And I talk with her and I met her kids and we get along. I met their parents. And everything seems to be going so well. And I feel like we could have a long-term relationship. And I'm listening to him share this story. And my heart is breaking because I really want him to be happy. But I can't officiate. I'll attend, but I cannot bless that union. And my friend is asking me these questions because he's probing and he's asking for theological permission. He's asking for my permission as a theologian that it's okay for you to marry an unbeliever. But see, the real question is not whether it's morally permissible. You know, the teenager's question, how far can I go, right? Is it theologically permissible to get married to an unbeliever? See, that's the wrong question. The real question is, what do you really want? What do you really want? That question will cut to the chase of whether your decisions are right or wrong before God. Well, we celebrate communion on the first Sunday of every month, and this is our first Sunday. I'm going to ask the ushers to come forth, Taking communion is like singing a song. It's an expression of our desire to know God, so that when you receive the communion elements today and when you take it, at the very least what you're saying is, God, I want to know you. It is my prayer for myself, and this is my theme verse for the year. And it's my prayer for you, Apostle Paul. I consider everything rubbish, that I may experience the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord. Isn't that a great theme verse? Consider everything rubbish, if it means that I get to know my Jesus more. And so, as the ushers pick up the wine. We'll start with the wine. So if you go up and get the wine, they're going to come down and they're going to dispense it to you. And as they do, just ask yourself, you know, it's the theme of the sermon. What is it that I really want? God, show me whether this is really what I want. And whatever your answer, let your prayer be, may I consider everything rubbish that I may know Christ. On that last night, Jesus gathered his disciples together, and they celebrated Passover. And he says in Luke 22, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I will not eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And then he took a cup. And when he had given thanks, he said, take this, divide it amongst you. For I tell you, from now on, I will not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And they took it and they drank it together.